You are listening to the Riverfront Church Podcast, a place to explore faith, history, ideas, and more.
Friends, we are so excited that you are joining us for another episode of the Riverfront Church Podcast. We are so enthusiastic and joyful to have Professor Rick Elgindy here and sharing his perspective and being part of this conversation. I am Pastor Emma, and I also have with me my colleagues,
Pastor Chelsea
and Pastor Edwin.
Friends, we are excited to have Rick Elgindy back on our podcast to continue the conversation about how faith and our politics intersect. If you missed our first podcast with Rick Elgindy, it is a two-parter. And we jump all over the place about whether how our faith is both public and private. We talk a lot about where we see God in our politics and where we don't see God in our politics. And so if you missed that discussion, I invite you to find it.
Well, thanks. It's great to join you again. My beloved mother listened to those episodes, in fact, and she said, I enjoyed it, but your answers were really long. So I'm gonna try to keep it a little shorter this time. We'll see if it makes it more listenable.
Make them tweetable and soundbite. I like the long answers. And you know, I was talking to a friend yesterday, and podcasts are the listening downloads, subscriptions, and overall listening audience for podcasts are like way up through the roof, partly the pandemic and having time. But the other thing that if you look at the shows that are rated high up there, they're ones that are willing to go to like to ask really tough questions, to explore taboos, and that really go in depth on topics, which is fascinating, because that the opposite is what I experience of social media. So feel free to answer as you feel led. You can maybe experiment, you can mix it up. My family's from Guatemala, and so I always wanna say Elgindy, you know, Rick Elgindy. I just always wanna say that, I'm always tempted. So that may come out, and as I've shared with the professor, I may once in a while call him professor, because this is a cultural thing. But I wanted to start off, is that okay, Pastor Chelsea, with a question? And this is just for context. It's just for our listeners who might think, oh my gosh, politics is so foreign, it's so out there, or it's really private. It just happens in the voting booth and just me, myself, and I, or it really, you know, has nothing to do with what goes on Sunday morning and worship and all that. Could you begin with telling us who are some, besides Jesus, who are some theologians, church leaders, you know, thought leaders of faith who you look to, who have been inspiring to you on the journey as you reflect on faith and politics?
I appreciate that you've disqualified Jesus from the answer there. Speaking of low-hanging fruit, indeed. So I think there are a lot of people who are doing interesting work on that. One of my teachers from Chicago, Franklin Gamwell, he goes by Chris, he's now retired. He wrote a book called, I think it's called Democracy as a Christian Vocation. And that's a really useful book. I also have taught, including I've taught Chelsea, one of my favorites, Charles Matthews, who wrote a couple of books called Republic of Grace and The Theology of Public Life. And those are interesting ways of thinking about how political participation, including participation in a democratic republic, are part and parcel of Christian discipleship, and not just sort of an accidental, you know, thing we have to do or thing we do in some other part of our life. So that's really useful. Models of actual sort of Christian engagement. I'm inclined toward people like Dorothy Day a lot. I'm thinking about assigning her Reckless Way of Love in one of my courses next semester. Obviously, you've got an incredible batch of leaders in the civil rights movement who are super useful. One of the ones that I think doesn't get enough credit is Bayard Rustin, who has a lot of Quakerism in his background. He has this really interesting, sort of explicitly nonviolent, but really engaged in the process of organizing. You'll see Rustin in a lot of pictures from the March on Washington in 1963, but he wasn't one of the main speakers. He's sort of widely acknowledged to have this incredible talent for organizing and advocacy. He was also a gay man in the 60s. And sometimes I think the civil rights movement kept him out of the limelight because of that. So he's a really great exemplar, I think, also. And of course, as Emma has suggested, John the Baptist, there's a political witness for you of a radical and sort of countercultural form. So spanning the centuries, there is such a great cloud of witnesses. So that's a good start, but I think we need like everybody on board for thinking about how to undo, you know, that division between religion and politics that we talked about last time. I think that's one of the central vocations for Christians today, and I'm grateful for those who've helped me think through that.
And one last question, again, by way of context. I'm tempted, like, this could be its own episode, right? But what is the history of that? Because it seems like medieval theologians, it seems like very early church theologians were very comfortable talking about, even if they still made distinctions, but they were willing to talk about politics and faith pretty blatantly and openly. So I'm just thinking of, City of God. I'm thinking of, or jumping over to Martin Luther and the Two Swords, and just kind of jumping around. It seems like they're some of the heavyweight, you know, theologians who carry a lot of weight in the church were willing to talk about it, have addressed it in numerous ways. What happened there? Like, when was like this great divorce? Does it have to do with fundamentalism? What do you see that as? And that's just by way of context.
You're tempting me toward a very long answer. So I'll throw some highlights out there to trace, like, here's the table of contents of the 2000 page book that would actually begin to answer that question. The excesses of the medieval church in particular lead to a growing protest on behalf of people who thought of themselves as civil or temporal authorities against the specifically earthly authority of the Roman Catholic Church. That begins in the late medieval era. You can read the Superfund Defensor of Pacis from Marsilius of Padua, as I was once required to do many years ago. And that's building through the 13th century and moving forward from there until something sparks in the Reformation. And we know the sort of headline story of the Reformation, but the background story of the Reformation is also that there are power moves made by, like, German princes, for instance, who, in sheltering Luther from the Catholics, are also asserting their rights vis-a-vis, like, the Vatican as a political authority. So by the time you get to Luther's Two Kingdoms doctrine, you're already seeing a divide between a political realm and a spiritual or a religious realm. Now, Luther thinks that the Two Kingdoms doctrine is useful for explaining to you the two ways that God is governing the world. But he also gives a certain kind of autonomy to the political world. And that's sort of the beginning of this division between religion and politics, as if they're spheres that operate independently. And that spheres language comes from the more Calvinist tradition, but there's a way it's present in Luther as well. And that, here's the final stage of the very, very short version of the answer. That is sort of picked up and amplified by the emergence of the modern European nation state, which is a genuinely distinct historical form of government. It emerges not without precedents, but it emerges in the 16th and 17th centuries in Europe. And it is very interested in creating a sphere for religion as a way of differentiating what it does, right? So the story that emerges from the 30 Years' War in the 17th century is that religions do violence. And the way to solve that is for a secular state to be a neutral arbiter, to have a monopoly on legitimate violence, and to guarantee a certain secular peace. And that story more or less is continuous with the story we have in the 21st century about something we call religion and something we call politics. And like I always say, and may have said last time, the people in first century Palestine were perfectly capable of distinguishing God from Caesar, but they didn't know what religion and politics were. We know that in the modern era, particularly because of how the nation state has defined what is religion and what is politics. And the usefulness of categories like civil religion that we talked about last time is specifically naming how there's a lot of porousness in that divide, how a lot of the things that pass themselves off as secular are actually forming us in the ways that religions sometimes do. And a lot of the things that we think of as religious traditions have implications for how we live in the social world as well. So it's a very long story. It has chapters, it has phases, but the first and sort of foregrounded theme that we need to talk about in today's world is how the nation state sort of distinguishes itself as a non-religious entity and how that's worth some skepticism.
So are we hearing it first that you're writing this book as we speak? You referred to chapters and the 2,000 pages. It sounds like you've got a book in your head.
No. Fortunately, I don't have to because a lot of folks have already written on this because I have no desire to. The amount of historical homework you have to do that responsively is really staggering. So in particular, William Kavanaugh's book, The Myth of Religious Violence, touches on some of that. And then he also has a collection of essays called Migrations of the Holy. That's a really good place to look there. He did his PhD at Duke, but we can forgive him for that. he's really a good place to start, and he's done a really rigorous job of treating history.
And for folks listening, if they can just hang their hat on something, are you using like the Peace of Westphalia as one of those markers, or do you find that to be an artificial marker? Do you think it's a little more porous than that in terms of the modern state?
That sort of stands in much the same way that like the conversion of Constantine stands in the fourth century, right? It not because it's the moment at which everything changes and on which everything depends, but it's a symbol for when a shift becomes codified and becomes explicit, right? So yeah, so 1648 as sort of a broad marker is a reasonable moment in which to name a shift. And that shift was in the works for centuries. It doesn't happen overnight. And of course we inherit it 400 years later in a different form, but something significant has changed, and that that treaty will point you to what it is. Again, that's a horrifically simplified story. If any of my church history colleagues are listening to this, I disavow that story immediately. But you'll start to see it differently. You'll start to see the nation state differently if you can tell the history behind its story in a little bit more detail.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And I totally get you're sort of caught in a corner there of you know, what's symbolic and oversimplifying it. But I'm hoping for our listeners, for them to have some kind of context that they can go, oh, okay, this point in time that we're roughly talking about.
Yeah. You need the textbook version of the story so that you can then sound smart by complicating the textbook version.
So you can have the Talmudic version, the exactly. Commentary.
I was just going to begin to shift us a little bit from this background that I think we've really set the stage with in the last couple of podcasts and now in the beginning of this one, to how this story begins to play out in the beginning, especially in the beginning of the founding of the United States. I'm also celebrating the fact that we just used Hamilton in worship on Sunday and that we have been talking about it as a community for the last few weeks. So mindful of that as well. And just really struck that, like, while the US Constitution doesn't have mention of God, that in each state's constitution, there is a mention of either God or specifically or the divine. We see mentions of God in the Declaration of Independence, in the Pledge of Allegiance, in so many other places. And so just wonder, like, what else sticks out to y'all, especially in how this theme of religion ties into the beginning of the US story.
One of the things that I sort of have rolling around in my head, and I'm not sure if it answers or addresses your question, Chelsea, or not, is the intermingling and messiness of the ideas of morality and right behavior, and specifically Christianity for so long, and how, especially in American history and politics and things like that, those things have gotten so intermixed, it's hard to pull them apart. And so now the rhetoric, when you talk about some of these moral things or faithful things, it has gotten turned upside down and into something hateful or hurtful. I don't know if that really addresses where you were going, but that's kind of what I've got rolling around in my head and that I'm wrestling with.
Yeah, I'm glad you didn't throw away your shot to use Hamilton. So it's interesting, right? Because we've long had this conversation about whether the U.S. is a Christian nation, and particularly whether our sort of official forms of government are themselves Christian. And it's difficult to find, like you named, Chelsea, difficult to find a lot of evidence of that in the original text. So the main body of the Constitution acknowledges the existence of religion twice, by my count. In Article 6, it forbids religious tests for office. And then my particular favorite is in Article 2, where it's talking about the oath of office, I think, that people may swear or affirm their fidelity to the Constitution of the people of the United States. And the option to affirm there exists because of the Sermon on the Mount, which says, you know, swear no oaths. And one of my favorite trivia questions, we'll see if Chelsea
remembers. That's a real fun fact. I'm going to pause you there. That's
you looked this up, didn't you?
Yeah, fun fact.
Who is it? Who's the only president to affirm rather than swear?
I guess it would be Jefferson.
Ooh, an interesting guess. That's not quite right. Other guesses, maybe.
All right, we get two more just to make it fun.
Yeah, Edwin, what's your guess?
What would be my guess? I'd have to think about that a little bit more.
I feel like it's somebody really recent. So Nixon, nope, okay. Then I have
a lot
no
of people wonder if it's Nixon or Hoover because they were Quakers.
Okay, so I wasn't way far off.
But they do both swear, yeah.
All right, I'm just gonna go, I'm gonna just say for no reason, Teddy Roosevelt.
Another good guess. It's actually Franklin Pierce. He pronounced his last name Pierce, of course.
Yes.
This is Frank. Not an exemplary president in any respect, except interesting insofar as he affirmed rather than swore. So those are the two sort of mentions of religion. That second one is pretty implicit too.
I'm gonna say that you should add this to your, for Rick's students, he often will bring us back from break with a fun history trivia question. If you get it right, you get a signed copy of the US Constitution signed by him. So if-
Not by anyone who wrote it, right? Yeah, just
yeah,
me.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't know if that question is in your trivia pockets, but it should be.
It should be, yeah, it should be. Of course, you have the First Amendment, which mentions both free exercise and disestablishment. And then you have the four mentions of God in the Declaration, the laws of nature and nature's God, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, appealing to the supreme judge of the world for the rectitude of their intentions and firm reliance on the divine providence, all of which are kind of vague. Divine providence is a little more than deism, right? So we're usually told that the baseline faith of the founding generation was this idea that there's a God who's the moral center of the universe and who sets it up, after which time it runs like a clock. The divine providence is a little tricky to square with what we usually think of in relation to deism. I guess if you want to see the law-likeness of the world as providential, then maybe it's still deistic, but it sounds more theistic rather than deistic in that particular moment. But still, it's really tricky to find the evidence in the official documents themselves. Now, one of the things we talk about in a lot of our courses is how the structures of American institutions reflect a certain, maybe there's a suspicion of human sinfulness, right? And that's why we have things like checks and balances and separations of powers. Or maybe it assumes that social good is going to be accomplished by the churches. You may remember from 20 years ago, this compassionate conservatism idea, which I would say is no longer regnant on the American right. This was the Marvin Olasky sort of idea. He wrote a book called The Tragedy of American Compassion, where the argument was the founders and generations that followed them created a limited government because they assumed that churches and other mediating institutions were going to take care of people around them. And so the government didn't need to do that. So maybe that's one sort of argument for how the social world of the founding is religious and is influencing the institutions. But it's hard. You have to do a lot of inference to get to a Christian form of government. Now, of course, some of the founding fathers were Christian people and some were not. But I don't know. I don't think it's very easy to come down on that issue. It's manifestly true that the founding documents and the structures that they set up are influenced by the Western Enlightenment philosophical tradition. I mean, the Locke, Rousseau, Montesquieu world seems to me far more influential than any theological text I've read.
May I ask, because this is just, and again, this could be its own podcast, right? We're going to find that over and over again, but this is an interesting point of contention, I think, because there are, and I'm forgetting his name, there's a French, I think he's a French philosopher or historian who is a self-proclaimed atheist. I'm not sure if agnostic, but I think atheist, who basically was making the case for acknowledgement of religious influence in Europe in particular, right? So this was, you know, ways it's been shaped, not just in terms of the tragedy, like we were saying, the religious violence, you know, in the 30 Years' War and on and on and on. And to this day, sadly, that we still see. But specifically that some of its norms, its values, its cultures, its institutions had come out of, you know, in many ways, even directly out of vestiges of religious institutions and, you know, moral values coming out of the church and scripture and interpretation, et cetera, et cetera. But on the other hand, there'll be other atheist scholars who reject that, right? They'll point, and here I'm thinking of, he's a Harvard professor. And basically his theory is like the world is actually less violent than it's ever been. What's his name? It's totally escaping me. Steven Pinker. What is it?
Steven Pinker.
Yes, Steven Pinker. So Steven Pinker was interviewed and he basically said, no, it's the other way around, right? It's actually the Enlightenment has had this amazing impact on religion and secular governments. And that's why the world's a better place. But it's really interesting because, you know, there are ways in which, oh, this thing over here, it's like, well, no, that's really the secularism coming rise and the Enlightenment. And others would be like, well, but that's only giving rise because you have the ecosystem of this, of religious thought and behavior and moral things. So, I mean, that's just an interesting thing. Like where do you land on that? Or do you see it as a lot more, like it's a mixed picture?
I'm sure that my answer is going to fall into the mixed picture category. Maybe the first person you're thinking of was Alain de Botton, who runs the School of Life. Yeah, yeah. And that's interesting because his project is more or less like, how do we create religion for atheists? How do we create religion without the supernatural or without God or without any whatever category he wants? Because he sees the value of social cohesion and having this articulation for life's big moments and small moments, and cultivating virtues of reflection and practical wisdom. And so that's interesting to me. So I think Pinker is mostly wrong. And I think he's wrong in the way that the nation state encourages us to be wrong, which is naming religion as like the bad object of our politics, as if we would be fine if not for irrationalism, if not for people who hold to these intrinsically violent and or outdated forms of belief, et cetera, et cetera. And the argument, I mean, we're simplifying substantially here, but the argument is that as European modernity progresses, so the world becomes a better, safer, more interesting place. And I think all those categories are bad. They're bad because they take for granted the distinction between religion and politics, the distinction between modernity and what came before it. I just haven't sort of read cover to cover all the Pinker stuff, so I'm not sure how it accounts for the very real dislocations that we're very aware of in 2020. I mean, it's not obvious to me that European modernity, and specifically in its capitalistic form, is on balance a good thing for the planet and its inhabitants. I think it's very tricky, and it's tricky in a way that I want to change the terms of the debate, right? So I'm not just pro-religion. I mean, I'm a seminary professor, but I don't feel much of a stake in defending something called religion. Rather, I really want to interrogate why we're using those terms, why we think we can gather complex social phenomena in the categories of religion and politics, or secularity and religion, or violence and nonviolence, as if violence isn't coded into many of our social institutions, which is exactly what we're talking about in 2020. So I'm really skeptical about that. I mean, hey, I'm grateful for the genuine achievements that mean that my life in 2020 is not characterized by a lot of overt violence. Like, I want to acknowledge that and be grateful for it. But I'm not impressed by the society that has achieved that for me and for not everyone. And I'm not sure it achieved that specifically because it was modern or secular or something else. So yeah, a mixed blessing. My object isn't to say the nation state is just bad, or that, you know, we can't, or that we, I'm certainly not a theocrat. Like, I don't want a sort of avowedly Christian social order. But a lot of the terms that we inherit are worth a lot of suspicion.
That's helpful. That's really helpful.
I think so many times when we use those words of religion or politics, they are almost shields that people can hide behind and say, I'm not going to have these certain conversations because I'm in these circles, or, you know, that's in the political realm, and I just don't talk about that. Or the opposite way around, of we want to keep your religion out of these political discussions, which is so hard to do, that I think in some ways they've become either a shield or a barrier or something really complicated to hide behind, or to protect you, or to block conversation as well.
Totally, yeah. Richard Rorty, who's himself a pragmatist atheist, called religion a conversation stopper at one point in his career, and he kind of revised that as time went on. But you know, the argument there is that it's really hard to argue with someone's religion, and so when you invoke it in public conversation, you do harm to your fellow citizens who are trying to reason with you. Now, even Rorty acknowledged that the category religion there is not exactly the culprit, that it's any conversation stopper would be bad, whether it's religious or not. And I think that was really evident in the Amy Coney Barrett conversation we had, which picked up the same Amy Coney Barrett conversation from 2017, right? And it seemed to me that the problem wasn't that she was religious. I mean, the problem was that people objected to the actual material convictions that she had. Like, no one would have objected on the grounds of her religion if she'd been equally intensely religious, whatever that means, but equally faithful to something, to take an instance at random, like Unitarian Universalism, right? Like, no one would have objected to her religious convictions if they had been sort of egalitarian in nature. So it's not actually the religious convictions in their religiosity as such, it's what they actually are. And I think that's a way of starting to like nudge ourselves out of thinking that it's religion in particular that's the problem, rather than like, what are we saying? Because the flip side of that is that then we find ourselves in conversations saying, well, I have to respect these positions because they're religious, right? And I don't think that pleading that a certain set of convictions are religious is like a get out of jail free card for what those convictions are. So shifting those terms, right? So that we're talking materially, we're actually talking to each other about the things we're saying and not just sorting things into categories of this is publicly relevant or this isn't publicly relevant. That's what I'm for.
Yeah, and I'm really struck by the ways that we, as three pastors and a public theology professor on this call, that like by our titles and by our vocation and calling, like enter into spaces. And I'm just struck by the ways that we, that a lot can be assumed about us, sometimes even before we have spoken, and how just the work that I believe that I'm at least called to of unraveling some of those expectations and some of those assumptions, and just really aware of like, how am I entering space to allow folks to question, and how to push back against some of those assumptions.
I think too, Pastor Chelsea, about the idea that whenever we hear people making these strong religious stands, in whatever way we associate that with this person is making, or maybe not we, but people associate the strong religious stands with having strength in the political realm. Like if they are willing to put their neck out there and say whatever it is, whether we agree to it or not, then that translates to, well, they are gonna make strong stands and they have the potential to make change whether we believe in it or not. And so that mixing up of strength, religious conviction-y strength and strength of ability to change things, I think makes it really messy too.
And the nuance, going back to what you were saying, Rick, that like, let's say in Amy Coney Barrett's a pure example, right? The interesting thing about Catholicism is the spectrum of belief and practice and liturgy, Eastern Rite versus Western Rite. I mean, the incredible diversity. You know, I try to remind folks who are in quote unquote more progressive denominations, Catholics are the most diverse Christian group, let's say, in the world. I mean, they cover, you know, all the continents, they cover all the languages, all the cultures, all the colors, and even the theological spectrums. So it's even in that case of where you're saying, well, this is just a religious conviction versus, no, I just disagree with what you believe, where you end up. I don't disagree why you end up there in terms of, well, your why is your religious conviction. It's like, but I disagree with where you end up with it. And where we lose the nuance is then we make all these assumptions about Catholics, like we did with President Kennedy, and the same thing with Amy Coney Barrett. We've seen it before, as opposed to the nuance that, well, actually no two Catholics believe the same thing either. And so how do we open up the space instead of just objectifying each other with more labels and saying, well, actually let's enter into dialogue here where we might disagree fundamentally. But that's not taking away the fact that, you know, your religious conviction and somebody else who shares that conviction may end up in very different interpretive stances.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's, I understand why we do this, why we use like identity as a shorthand for position and argumentation and conviction. But I think, you know, what Chelsea was pointing to a moment ago is that one of the roles we have, I think all Christians have this, but one of the roles that's foregrounded in our work is contending for what that identity can mean and contending for what the resources that identity provides can accomplish for us. And so, yeah, like my problem with Amy Coney Barrett isn't that she's Catholic. It's that she's not Catholic like Dorothy Day is Catholic. I mean, the problem is not like religious conviction and politics. I like William Barber's religious convictions and politics. It's like, let's have an argument about whose convictions work better as an expression of our consensus, whose convictions do a better approximation of what we understand to be justice, and so on down the line. And I want people exercising official state power to be careful in how they're thinking about the relationship of official institutions to personal conviction. But we've become, I think, at once too deferential to religion, as if it allows us just to claim sort of anything and claim its protection in public argument as a result, and also too dismissive, as if it's sort of merely religion that we can't sort of argue with, and that doesn't merit an argument. So I'm always in favor of actually talking about the material differences that we have and trying to sort them out on the grounds that you mentioned, Edwin, of the internal diversity of all of our religious traditions, Catholicism in particular, for reasons you mentioned. But really the internal diversity of all the traditions that we inhabit and how they can be pushed toward their more just, more fair incarnations.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Riverfront Church Podcast. You can connect with us online at riverfrontwilmo.com or on Facebook. Just search for Riverfront Church in Wilmington, Delaware. May God meet you where you are and lead you where you are meant to go.